Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning to 2 Chronicles 24, verse 19. The sympathy of this congregation is extended to the family of Mrs. Lanier Smith of Napton, Missouri, in the sudden death of her eldest son, Edwin Smith, of Springdale, Maryland, on July 3rd of 2003. Our sympathy is further extended to his sister, Melinda Smith Smith, and to his brothers, Cordell and Barclay Smith. He was a gentleman that I met on one occasion, and that's when Tim and Melinda were married. I was impressed with him then. He was a dignified individual. He worked in the Washington, D.C. area, although living in a suburb of Maryland. I have learned that he was not only an avid researcher of the war between the states, but in fact was an expert. He was such an expert that he would give impromptu tours of battlefields all the way from Gettysburg to certain ones down in Virginia. And he would go to Gettysburg every 1st of July, the 4th of July period. The Gettysburg was fought on the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July. And he would give impromptu tours of the battlefield. And he knew every nick and cranny of it, what time things occurred, who did what and who didn't do what, therefore resulting in this and that. Ultimately, the defeat of the Confederate Army on that occasion. But I think it's significant that the time he died, July the 3rd of 2003, was about the time Pickett took the high ground. So I salute him on that final tour of Gettysburg. So our sympathy is extended to you, Melinda, and your entire family. In our study, we are noting kings who didn't do nearly as well on the battlefield as the Yankee army did on that occasion. 2 Chronicles 24:19 is where we are in our study of Joash, king of Judah. God sent prophets to them, meaning Judah, to bring them back to the Lord. Though they, the prophets, testified against them, they would not listen. We will be studying briefly the concept of reversionism and how it took Joash on an intense spiral downward from his earlier heights under the leadership of Jehoiada. There was one of these prophets that is mentioned by name, and he becomes a central character in our ongoing saga. Verse 20 is where he speaks out against the people of Judah. Thus God has said, "Why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper?" Implication: if you do obey the mandates of the Lord, you will prosper as a client nation. And the reason they're not prospering, because you have forsaken the Lord, and the forsaking here has to do with apostasy of idolatry, moving back into Baal worship. He also has forsaken you. That indicates that he has withdrawn his divine protection. The wall of fire has been lifted, and client nation Judah is under national discipline. Verse 21. So they, the people of Judah, slapped their foreheads and said, "We have been wrong. We will adjust immediately." Well, no, that's not what it says. That's never apparently what it says, except on very rare occasions when prophets come and say, "You're way out of line. You are moving into wheel tracks of wickedness, and you need to right your ship." Never happens except on very rare occasions for the reason of reversionism. And we will note that a little later. So they conspired against Zechariah. At the command of King Joash, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord, where Joash had been anointed king of Israel, standing by the tower Jachin. It is in this area, the inner court, in which Joash asked that his minions carry out the execution of God's prophet Zechariah. That is complete inversion of thought. Thus, Joash the king did not remember the kindness which Zechariah's father, Jehoiada, had shown him, but murdered his son. And as he died, Zechariah said, "May the Lord see and avenge." One of the major duties of a prophet is to warn God's people that they have gone astray. This duty is among those passed from the prophets of old to the pastor-teachers of the church age. It is the duty of the pastor to analyze the zeitgeist in which his ministry functions and to discern its spiritual implications. There are numerous keys that assist in the doctrinal scrutiny of the citizen's inventory of thought, and once you learn establishment viewpoint from the Scripture, and then you're able to correlate that with a doctrine you know as you grow in grace, then you can clearly evaluate the events of your day, and you can discern whether the nation itself is headed in a wrong direction or whether it is going in a right direction. I mentioned a few obvious examples on Thursday having to do with assaults on the four divine institutions. And I mentioned those issues in order that you could see how clearly we have gone astray. The people have lost the thought, and we are acting silly. I mentioned that when I was a child and I would start cutting up, my mother would tell me I was acting silly and I needed to stop that. And that's to be expected of children. But it is not to be expected of adults. Adults in this country are acting silly. And we defined that as simply being out of control, foolish, having no common sense or direction. It is silly, therefore, to turn a blind eye for adults, for leadership in a client nation, to turn a blind eye toward sexual perversions, drug use, marital infidelity, and the devaluation of marriage. It is silly for adults to think it's just fine for children to be reared, taught, led, counseled, and entertained by homosexuals. These people are engaged in a behavior that is a gross sin, which should no more be introduced to them than pornography, X-rated movies, and tours of bordellos. There are television programs, recorded music, video games, movies, books, sex education classes in schools, which indoctrinate children into a way of thinking that is destroying their souls, and it's because adults are acting silly. Lucifer, therefore, is engaged in an all-out assault on all Americans, young and old alike. He has virtually won the battle for the minds and souls of those who populate this client nation, and those who have not been converted have been neutralized by case law. And this is where we stopped our study the other evening, so that we could evaluate a few points on that. We've studied this in a bit of detail in the early chapters of Clanking Chains. I remind you for a moment of those studies. Case law is the aggregate of reported cases which form a body of law on a given subject, and then they supersede legal statutes. For example, the accumulation of case law, especially in the 20th century, case law related to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, now supersedes statutes that governed church-state relationships prior to Everson versus Board of Education in 1947. What this means is that the Establishment Clause now takes precedence over the Free Exercise Clause, and therefore you are not free to exercise your faith in public, in certain environments, in certain locations, because the Establishment Clause trumps you. Case law has established this, not the Constitution. So 12. Christianity in the United States is being compromised by an evolving cultural transition, which is drifting away from a traditional worldview to a progressive worldview. I have this article to read you. It was sent to me. It is from the Internet, but from a reliable source. It is copyrighted by World Net Daily. and it was posted on July the 7th of 2003. It has to do with an appearance, a rare appearance, by a couple of Supreme Court justices who appeared on George Stephanopoulos' program, ABC News This Week. And here are a few of the comments that occurred during that exchange. In a rare appearance on a television news show, Supreme Court Justice Stephen G. Breyer questioned whether the U.S. Constitution, the oldest governing document in use in the world today, will continue to be relevant in an age of globalism. Speaking with ABC News' This Week host George Stephanopoulos and his colleague Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Breyer took issue with Justice Antonin Scalia, who, in a dissent in last month's Texas sodomy ruling, contended the views of foreign jurists are irrelevant under the U.S. Constitution. Breyer and others had cited foreign judiciaries in coming to their conclusion about the Texas sodomy case and how they ruled in their countries. And Justice Scalia said that this was ridiculous. Breyer had held that a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that homosexuals had a fundamental right to privacy in their sexual behavior showed that the Supreme Court's earlier decision to the contrary was unfounded in Western tradition. That is a bold-faced lie. Western tradition has never supported that until the Europeans went crazy within the last 30 years. The Europeans are acting silly. And they acted silly before we started. We see all the time, Justice O'Connor and I and others, how the world really is growing together. Oh, really? We're just all holding hands and singing Kumbaya now, aren't we? Maybe we should tell this to our forces who are engaged still in Iraq. They walk down the streets of Baghdad and the Iraqis just run up and hug them and offer them a drink. We're growing together, according to the justice. He continues, through commerce, through globalization, see, that's the satanic ideal. This is all ambassador demon stuff. You do get this, don't you? Through commerce, through globalization, through the spread of democratic institutions, through immigration to America, it's becoming more and more one world of many different kinds of people. And how they're going to live together across the world will be the challenge. And whether our Constitution and how it fits into the governing documents of other nations, I think, will be a challenge for the next generations. That's Justice Breyer. In the Lawrence versus Texas case decided June 26th, Justice Anthony Kennedy gave as a reason for overturning a Supreme Court ruling of 17 years earlier upholding sodomy laws that it was devoid of any relevance on the views of a wider civilization. Well, you should not. I told you Thursday, this is normal. This is to be expected. Client nations rise and fall. And when they rise, there's only one thing left to do, and that's to fall. And we're in a steady downslide, and I see no hope except for those of you who gather here in this church and others like you. Jesus Christ controls history. We can get the inventory up. Things will change because certain people will die, as we're about to note for Joash. When it comes time to take leadership out, God knows how to do it. And Joash is about to meet his maker. Christianity in the United States is being compromised by an evolving cultural transition, which is drifting away from a traditional worldview to a progressive worldview. I want to go back to something we looked at in a previous study. It is the definition of traditionalists and progressives. I get this from Herbert Cole's book, Archetype the Zeitgeist, page 158. He writes that there are a number of words used to indicate the nature and direction of social, political, and economic change. Certain words define this. The status quo is the current historical situation in a particular community, state, or nation. What's the current zeitgeist? That's the status quo. Traditionalists are people who want to maintain the status quo. Progressives are people who advocate a new social, political, or economic order that provides for more personal and group freedom and a greater equalization of opportunity, wealth, and power. A greater equalization of opportunity, wealth, and power means socialism. Reactionaries are people who want to return to an older order characterized by some traditional authoritarian rule. That's us. Or it should be, if you know your doctrine. We are reactionaries. We are people who want to return to an older order that is characterized by some traditional authoritarian rule. For example, the Constitution. So that reminds you of progressives vis-a-vis traditionalists. 13. As a result, those in various areas of leadership are willing to allow establishment and doctrinal principles to be altered by this transition of thought. We have moved from traditionalists to progressivists in our client nation, and that always creates an historical downtrend. You must remain traditional if you are to survive as a client nation. And what is traditionalism to a client nation? It must be founded on the order code, or the Ten Commandments, which organizes the spiritual life of the people first, and then secondly, the civil life of the people. Now, you always want to wrinkle your brow and say, well, what about the separation of church and state? I am not speaking here of government documents. I'm speaking of God's document in a client nation. The people, independent of the government, must subscribe to the order code. The people must order themselves spiritually and then civilly under these ten concepts. And when their souls are so riveted on these concepts, they will insist that leadership comply by the way they vote. And when there is a deviation from the order code, it will be reflected in the type of leadership that is put in power. Those in various areas of leadership are willing to allow establishment and doctrinal principles to be altered by this transition of thought, that being progressivism. Certain expressions of the prevailing public opinion that emerge from the progressive ideology include the following, which appear on the cover of the March-April 2003 issue of Israel My Glory. This is a magazine to which I subscribe. It is published by what are called generally Messianic Jews. Jews who are scholars in Hebrew and in Greek, but who have been converted to Christianity and therefore publish this magazine entitled Israel My Glory. But it has excellent articles in it, and these fellows have good, clear, dispensational, premillennial theology. On the cover of this issue is a list of certain quotes. I've selected three. This by Dalen Glanton in the Chicago Tribune. Christian conservatives have declared war on civil libertarians for the soul of America. By Martin E. Marty of Newsweek, the problem isn't with Bush's sincerity, but with his evident conviction that he's doing God's will. That's a major problem today, according to Martin E. Marty. And by the way, I know Marty is an author. I've got a couple of his books. Gary Watson, by the way, was planning a book burning. Somehow that got canceled in the... I may bring Martin's work down to the ranch next time you propose that. He said, what, burning books? Yes, I have books that I won't even throw away. I have books that I've accumulated over 30 years that I won't throw away because I think others might read them. So Gary's got a magnificent idea. From Nicholas D. Kristof in the New York Times. I tend to disagree with evangelicals on almost everything, And I see no problem with aggressively pointing out the dismal consequences of this increasing religious influence. Increasing religious influence? I'd love to think it was increasing and was having influence. 14. These statements reflect the growing hostility felt by progressives toward traditional Christianity, and that's the cultural war. Yes, there is a cultural war, but it is religious. All wars, by the way, eventually stem back to some type of code of ethics that come into conflict with someone else's code of ethics, and primarily that means religion. So there is conflict in our nation culturally. But cultures are based on the cult. That's how you get culture. What's the cult? Now, the cult has a negative definition primarily in our society today, but it doesn't necessarily have that across the board. You can have a cult where people burn animals and do hat dances around totem poles and all the rest. That's a cult. They usually involve drug abuse and so on, sexual perversions, sacrifice of animals, even children. That's a cult as we understand it. But in a strict definition, the cult is the prevailing religious concept of a given society. And therefore, it is the religion that begins to establish what the culture is. The culture subscribes to a code of ethics. That code of ethics is some form of religious concepts that have been established and put in either writing or oral law, and the people rally around that collectively. The laws are established around the leadership of the cult, and then the culture emerges from that. So culture goes back to the cult. And we have a cultural war here because the progressives are opposed to the cult that established our traditionalist culture. And they are taking it apart piece by piece. And Christians stand by and say, well, okay, I don't want to be thought mean-spirited. Those Christians are no better, and they probably are no worse than Joash. So these statements reflect the growing hostility felt by progressives toward traditional Christianity. And to be fair, believers have no love lost for progressives. But the issue is not the conflict, but the willingness of Christians to be intimidated by the verbal blasts of the anti-religious. To be intimidated by them, rather than stand up and stand fast and watch the deliverance of the Lord, but never to compromise truth. 15. When leadership compromises truth in order to comply with prevailing public opinion, then divine discipline is sure to follow, and that's where we are. I don't know squat about economics. I really don't. Joe Henry balances the checkbook. I wouldn't have a prayer. In fact, if Joe Henry should be so rude as to die on me, some of you are going to have to help me find somebody that knows something about numbers. I will overdraw. I may have $10 million in the account and think I'm bankrupt. I have no clue. I know nothing of numbers, but this I've been able to understand from some of you who are able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. That our economy is shot. That's what you're telling me. I don't know. Take that or leave it. But one of the cycles of discipline to a client nation in decline is economic downturn. And everything that Allen does, he raises interest rate, he lowers interest rate. He actually shows some emotion at a congressional hearing or he doesn't. Raise taxes, cut taxes. Bush is lying, Bush is telling the truth. People have a headache in Mongolia or they're feeling good today. Whatever is happening doesn't seem to be able to turn the economy around. Why is that? Jesus Christ controls history. Divine discipline is sure to follow when we as a people in a client nation start subscribing and complying with prevailing public opinion. That's what faced Joash when the officials of Judah petitioned him for permission to reinstitute the worship of Baal. The officials came forward and said, "We would like to reinstitute the worship of Baal." And he said, "Well, I think that's fine. Go ahead." He's the king of Israel. And we noted the responsibilities of the king of Israel in a previous study, Tuesday or Thursday it was. And his job is to control the spiritual life of the country. And if the priesthood goes astray, he's to go over there and kick shins and take names. And he is not to listen to however how many officials come down to Jerusalem and say to him, "Well, we're in the majority and we think we ought to be able to worship Baal again." And he should have fired them all. He should have lined them up, accused them of blasphemy, convicted them, for which they would have been marched to the city limits and stoned to death. You say, "How harsh?" Well, you think harsh. Wait till the client nation moves into idolatry and you'll see harsh. And I will enunciate. The pusillanimous Joash complied, and soon prophets began to preach against his hypocrisy. Prophets began to preach against his hypocrisy. They pointed out that for Joash to remain a follower of Jehovah, but to allow the worship of Baal in a client nation would rob it of its prosperity and call down divine discipline. Israel is our example and our illustration. They never survived historical downtrends or poor leadership or the negative volition of the population. And if they don't survive it, neither will any Gentile client nation. Nobody thought in the first century, when Rome became the first Gentile client nation, that it would ever fall, and it took 400 and, my math's not good, 30-some-odd years before it fell, after the resurrection of Christ. 400-plus. Rocked along. And then you had Nero, and Tiberius was in charge, and then Nero came along, and he executed a few of the apostles. And then after that, suddenly we have the Antonines. Jesus Christ controls history. Who would think with a sorry, decrepit, pitiful, degenerate leadership that this country endured for the entire 20th century that we could ever overcome this? Well, I'm sure people who functioned under Tiberius and Nero thought we can't last another 45 minutes. But somehow they endured until the Antonines came into power at the turn of the 2nd century. And they reigned for almost 100 years, great prosperity, and that's when incipient Christianity boomed throughout the Roman Empire. So, there's hope. You just stick to your knitting. 17. Zechariah, the grandson of Jehoiada, and we explain that, we'll evaluate a little more later, but it says son in the passage, but we are able to document it was his grandson because the line is often called father, and the children and grandchildren and so on are often called sons. So Zechariah was the grandson of Jehoiada. He was the most outspoken, and his admonitions against the Baal cult were so threatening to the newly established return to power by the ambassador demons. They'd been out of power for 23 years. That the worshipers of Baal were motivated to demand his execution. So here's how ambassador demons were working. They were neutralized when Joash was put on the throne at age 7 because he had the guidance and the leadership and the mentorship of the high priest Jehoiada, who was straight arrow. He understood the plan of God. He was high priest. He controlled the religious life of Israel as the major number one counselor to the king. And that remained so for 23 years before Jehoiada died. And when he did die, Joash was an adult now, and he had received great guidance from the high priest. And the ambassador demons were neutralized, except for the fact that he was negative volition through that time. What they were able to do to Joash's soul during those 23 years, we don't know. But we do know that as soon as Jehoiada died, Joash's spiritual life began to decay. And over the next 17 years, he went from what should have been the high ground all the way to the low ground, as we will demonstrate. Now, these ambassador demons, once Jehoiada died, seized that opportunity. They were able to discern that Joash was negative, and therefore demon influence was bombarded into his soul for 17 years. And they see now, as they also have manipulated the various leaders throughout Judah, from the local level all the way up to the tribal level, all of these officials, as they're called, the leadership core of Judah, they march into Jerusalem saying they want to return to Baal. That's what's going on in this country. Everybody wants to just, let's forget all this traditionalist stuff about how marriage is sanctified between a man and a woman. Let's forget all this traditionalist stuff about sexual mores. Let's forget all this traditionalist stuff about how everything is an absolute when really what's best for us is the thing we need to be able to do if we were truly free people. That if we get away from, you see, all this kind of thing is going on today, and it is part and parcel of ambassador demons influencing leadership and demon influence in the souls of the people, all because the old sin nature has been restrained by traditionalist thought, and the people who are out of control with their sin nature don't like that. I want to be able to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And I don't want any laws stopping me from any traditionalist bunch. And so, we wind up with Stephen Breyer and Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Anthony Kennedy and that kind of ilk infected by ambassador demons sitting on the highest court of the land. They make you want to puke. But I'll tell you this. These people in Judah had a comeuppance coming, and so do the people of this country. And they sit high and mighty now, but they have a fall on the Lord's agenda, scheduled and coming. And you'd best be able to avoid the hurricane and get in the eye, because this is what you need to happen in this country. We need to have all the pieces fall off, and as the whirlwind spins in the vortex, taking up those who are under divine indictment, we stand in the eye and remain prosperous. Believe it, for that's how client nations fall, and that's how pivots are preserved. What you do here is the most important event that takes place in this client nation today. Joash is a believer in reversionism. The problem with reversionism is that it blots out divine viewpoint, and the ability to recall and apply doctrine is neutralized. The ability to recall and apply doctrine is neutralized. Now, what doctrine he had, and he had some because he was doing well under Jehoiada's leadership, he understood some divine concepts, and he went along with that. But as soon as the spiritual leadership was removed, he did not have the moral courage to stand up to the threats and the challenges of the progressives. He didn't have enough doctrine to do that. So a definition of reversionism is found in the Colonel's book, Reversionism, 2nd edition, page 8. Many terms in fundamentalism have been used to describe reversionism, such as backsliding and falling away from God. Now, some I'm familiar with use those terms not for what we might refer to as reversionism or carnality, but a loss of salvation. That makes them a cult. Those who do not believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and that salvation and eternal life is based solely on faith alone in Christ alone, but something else that always involves human energy and human works, those people are not Christians. They are a cult. And I don't care what they call themselves, and they may have Christian vocabulary, but they have their own dictionary. And they are wrong. and they're leading people astray. Backsliding and falling away from God, however, is used by some to indicate reversionism. The colonel continues by writing that these terms have failed to fully define the concept. Reversionism is a maladjustment to the justice of God. For the unbeliever, the basic maladjustment is rejection of salvation. In the carnal believer, it is failure to rebound. But in the sphere of spiritual growth, maladjustment is reversionism, a state of spiritual decadence brought on by rejection or neglect of Bible doctrine. When a believer fails to grow spiritually or recedes, it is evidence of reversionism. When a believer fails to grow spiritually or recedes, it is evidence of reversionism. Consequently, reversionism is the condition of the believer who is negative toward Bible doctrine and refuses to function under GAP. Negative volition, refusal to rebound, therefore opting out of Bible class and spiritual growth. That has to result in reversionism because there becomes an immediate shrinkage of wheel tracks of righteousness and an immediate facilitation of wheel tracks of wickedness. The brain does not remain neutral. The soul controls what goes on there. And when the soul is not being fed, the brain is not being updated. And as a result, this believer remains in a state of carnality and is therefore under perpetual divine discipline. You take a client nation, you get a maximum number of believers who are out of fellowship, refuse to rebound, and do not grow in grace, and thus are in spiritual decline. They're under divine discipline, and collective divine discipline results in national discipline. Mankind, therefore, must either adjust to the justice of God, or the justice of God adjusts to him in either cursing or punitive action. 19. Joash was a reversionist, and as such he did not have the moral courage to stand up to the proponents of Baalism. No moral courage because he didn't have the thought, he didn't have the truth, he didn't have integrity, and what he had could not stand up under times of pressure. And therefore, he had no moral courage. When Zechariah's message turned out to be more than they could bear, the people demanded that the king dispense with him. And what Joash did here, what comes next, indicates how low he had sunk as a believer, and therefore brought upon discipline, not only upon himself, but the client nation Judah. We will resume the saga at about 10 minutes till the hour.